afternoon, Tri-States. This is IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, with Ken in his regular Friday reader seat, reading from the Friday, September 30th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And now our first piece from Above the Fold, Man Arrested After Duncan Robbery. Police said a man with a gun robbed an eatery in Dubuque on Thursday morning. Andrew M. Pop, 34, of Woodbury, Minnesota, was arrested less than 2 hours later in Maquoketa, Iowa, in a vehicle stolen from Lancaster, Wisconsin, according to Dubuque police. A press release states that the man, later identified as Pop, entered Duncan, 2660 Dodge Street, at about 5:15 a.m., displayed a handgun, and demanded cash. He then fled with an undisclosed amount of money. No injuries were reported. City cameras tracked the man's vehicle leaving the city on U.S. 61-151, and area agencies were notified, according to a press release. Court documents state that at about 7 a.m., the vehicle was located in a parking lot in Maquoketa, with Pop sleeping in the passenger seat. Police reviewed surveillance footage that showed Pop drive into the parking lot and then move to the passenger side of the vehicle. Pop told police that a friend gave him the vehicle, but authorities confirmed that it had been reported stolen. Documents state that the weapon used in the Duncan robbery was found in the vehicle. Maquoketa police stated that Pop refused to provide officers with his name or date of birth, but that when a search warrant was executed, a passport was found among Pop's possessions. He is charged in Iowa District Court of Jackson County with second-degree theft and interference with official acts. Dubuque police said they will seek a charge of first-degree robbery in connection with the Duncan gunpoint robbery. A conviction on that charge is punishable by up to 25 years in prison. Our next piece, right from the center of the front page, local college enrollment mixed. Local colleges reported a mix of enrollment trends as they continue to grapple with regional and national challenges, such as the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and declining high school age populations. The majority of local colleges that provided data to the Telegraph Herald reported enrollment figures that were lower than they were 5 years prior. However, half of those colleges saw their enrollment climb this fall compared to the same time last year. We're not quite back up to pre-pandemic enrollment levels, but we're moving in the right direction, said Herbert Riedel, president of Northeast Iowa Community College. Compared to the fall of 2017, enrollment this fall is down 4.7% at NICC, 7.5% at Loras College, 8% at Clark University, 25.2% at University of Dubuque, and 24.5% at University of Wisconsin-Platteville. At Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore, enrollment rose by 4.8% over those 5 years. Southwest Tech's enrollment also increased by 2.2% compared to the fall of 2021, and NICC and Clark recorded increases of 4% and 7.7%, respectively. Enrollment fell during that time by 3.8% at Loras, 11.4% at UD, and 3.7% at UWP. Despite the overall decrease, UWP reported a freshman class of 1,430 students, a 13% increase over last year, according to Interim Chancellor Tammy Ivetovich. That new freshman class is a really good sign for us that we're turning things in the right direction, she said. Our overall enrollment does continue to be down, but if we see a couple more years like this, I think we'll see our total enrollment start increasing again. Katie Glass, Executive Director of Marketing, Recruitment, and Foundation Services at Southwest Tech, attributed the college's rising enrollment to multiple factors, including growth in dual credit programs, an emphasis on student retention and business partnerships. She said the college's online programs, including new associate degrees in nonprofit leadership and data analytics, also have been popular with full-time working adults. We're partnering more and more with businesses that may have someone who never attended college to get them the skills they need to have a career they'll love, Glass said. Riedel said NICC officials continue to promote community college as a fiscally responsible choice. They also are targeting certain demographic groups among potential students, including homeschooled students, as well as adults who might have started college but not completed a degree. Julie Sirks, Vice President for Enrollment Management at Clark, said the university had grown in its non-traditional programs, including a new accelerated elementary education program that helps paraprofessionals or substitute teachers earn a degree to become teachers while continuing to work in classrooms. A lot of these programs that we're starting right now are very community-based, Sirks said, later adding, we're starting to look and say, what other programs can we adjust the modality of how we're teaching some classes that might be beneficial for our community in high-need areas? Mary Ellen Carroll, Senior Vice President at Loras, said the college's drop in enrollment was not unexpected due to the declining number of high school-age students across the Midwest as well as the current economy. It's a really tight labor market right now with lots and lots of opportunities for really decent earnings in the job market. And because there's such a shortage, there are less requirements for a four-year degree, she said. Companies are much more willing to do on-the-job training and be flexible. So students are being very reflective about their next step. And I think that, on the whole, is a good thing. She said Loras continues to update campus facilities, including recent heating, ventilation, and air conditioning improvements in the college's first-year residence halls, to attract students. Certain degree programs, including engineering and neuroscience, also have experienced growth. UD President Jerry Bullock said the ongoing recovery process from the pandemic has played a key role in the college's falling enrollment. In particular, the school has seen a decline in international students and those from lower-income backgrounds. Bullock said UD has expanded its national and international recruiting pool and maintains a robust admissions operation. He said he is confident about the university's future, but the higher education industry as a whole will continue to struggle. I've said all along that this is a three-year process of COVID-19 recovery, and we're midway through the second year, he said. All the prognosticators indicate that next fall is when it really hits because the financial ramifications from the drop-off in enrollment, the lack of funding, and the ending of COVID aid from the federal government all kind of comes together. Our final front page piece, our Friday, A Life Remembered. Food bank volunteer devoted to helping. Ken Zexer never was one to seek the spotlight. The longtime Dubuque resident always was content to do his work in the background, volunteering to organize food at the local food bank, mowing lawns for neighbors, or making a birdhouse to give away. He always let others go first in line at the buffet, a church function, or the airport. Even if he wasn't front and center, Ken was driven to help others. I always think of the last shall be first and the first shall be last, said Ken's wife Karen, quoting the Bible. Ken was always at the back end of the line. Ken died on June 4th at the age of 86. He was born on March 11, 1936, to August and Matilda Zexer in Fort Dodge, Iowa. He grew up with a humble farm life and attended a one-room schoolhouse. At one point, the family sold their pet pig to buy a bicycle so Ken's sister could give him a ride to school. "It was just a very simple life," said Karen. Ken played football and participated in theater in high school. He took a job as a soda jerk at the local drugstore. After graduating from Manson, Iowa High School and attending community college, Ken joined the Army and spent 3 years in Japan working as a military police officer. After returning to Iowa, he briefly worked in construction before embarking on a long career as an insurance adjuster. In 1971, a friend in the Quad Cities set Ken up on a blind date with Karen O'Connor. Ahead of the date, Ken called Karen and they talked for an hour. "For both of us introverts, that was a long conversation, maybe the longest we've had in our life," Karen said. Ken figured that if he could talk to Karen that long, they could go out on a date. They spent 3 hours talking over dinner. "I think we both knew that night we were a good fit," Karen said. They married on December 27, 1971, at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church in Dubuque, the town in which Karen grew up. The couple would make Dubuque their permanent home in 1989 when Karen took a job as a counselor at Wallard Catholic High School. Ken and Karen had 3 children, Ann Hankhouse, Ellen Tell, and Zachary Zexer. As a dad, Ken was a gentle and kind, the parent all the kids went to if they were hurt and needed a bandage or if they needed something sewn. The children cherished time they spent with him one-on-one at father-daughter and father-son activities. Ken had a basement workshop where he would use his woodworking skills to make toys for his children, a playhouse, a barn for a Barbie horse, Pinewood Derby cars. Anything that we would want, he would find a way to create, and it made it for us, Ann said. The family took regular camping and summer trips together, but Ken's favorite place to be was at home. Home was his haven, and it was where he found peace and security and comfort, Karen said. If we went on trips, I planned the trips. Ken cheered for the Iowa Hawkeyes and Notre Dame Fighting Irish and enjoyed collecting coins, though those hobbies seemed primarily to be about finding ways to spend time with the kids and grandkids. "I think a lot of it was really about us. Those were his avenues to have things to do with us," Zachary said. Faith was a key component of Ken and Karen's lives, and the couple spent many years as active members at St. Paul the Apostle Catholic Church in Davenport, Iowa, and then St. Joseph the Worker in Dubuque. Ken never was one to miss a Sunday Mass, and he helped count money, usher, and serve as a Eucharistic minister. His faith also worked in tandem with his love of serving people living on the margins and those who otherwise might not be noticed. Ken just felt an identification with people who were not the star because I don't think he felt like he was a star, and he was just like anybody else, and they were as important, and he wanted them to feel like they counted, Karen said. Ken spent more than 25 years volunteering or on the board for St. Vincent de Paul Society in Dubuque, and with St. Stephen's Food Bank. He was part of the group who helped the food bank find its current location and often could be found out and about early in the morning collecting day-old food from grocery stores and then bringing it into the food bank to sort and organize. He was pretty much out here almost every day for quite a while, and then as he started getting older, he slowed down a little bit, said Kathy Hutton, the site director for St. Stephen's, a branch of Riverbend Food Bank. But I always teased him and told him it was his second home, because it really was. Ken also frequently could be found at the St. Vincent de Paul Voucher Center. In 2017, Jim Rowling led an effort to reorganize the center to feel more like a grocery store for clients who came in needing food. Rowling turned to Ken to take over operation of the food section of the center, and Ken made sure everything was labeled neat and stocked. "We always kept the shelves full, thanks to Ken," said Rowling, president of the Dubuque Council of St. Vincent de Paul. Earlier this month, Ken posthumously was honored as St. Vincent de Paul's Volunteer of the Year. Ken battled cancer in the last years of his life, though he kept volunteering up until the last few months. The disease progressed, and he opted to receive hospice care, at peace that he had reached the end of his life. In the last days, his family was cleaning up his backyard when a neighbor stopped by to offer to do whatever the family needed to repay Ken's many kindnesses. "Ken didn't tell people how to do things. He showed them the way," Ellen said. "And those people now are reciprocating those kindnesses." Now we turn to some news from Dubuque and the Tri-States. And at the top of our fold, NICC unveils campus renovations. And we have a large picture inset with some people visiting on a second floor area of what is probably the campus. And beneath it, it reads, "Northeast Iowa Community College President Herbert Riedel speaks with Kelly Cooper and Dan White during a ribbon-cutting ceremony of the newly renovated campus in Piasta, Iowa, on Thursday." The $19.1 million renovation of the campus began in 2020. And we also have a second picture of a number of people walking in a large circular rotunda kind of area, flat ceiling to it. They're walking along, probably going on to classes. And beneath that one, we have the caption, "Attendees tour the newly renovated campus." And our article reads, "Afternoon sunlight streamed through the skylight of the newly renovated atrium at Northeast Iowa Community College's Piasta campus on Thursday as officials unveiled the updated facilities to the public. Our goal was to create a sense of place," said Marty Johnson, owner of Straka Johnson Architects, which served as the architect for the project. "We felt that after 40 years at this location, this facility needed a renaissance." NICC officials and community representatives gathered for a ribbon cutting and open house to celebrate the completion of the $19.1 million project, constructed in four phases beginning in 2020. The first two phases included construction of a link between the main building and the Industrial Technologies building, new classrooms and office space, a new dining area, and updates to classrooms. Phases 3 and 4 featured renovations to student services facilities, offices, the front entrance, parking lots and roadways, and the campus conference center. Rhonda Siebert, Associate Vice President for Operations, said the project reorganized the campus's main building so classrooms and offices are more centralized and the facility is easier to navigate. "Before, it was like this building was built in cubes and you just walked around like a mouse in a maze," she said, describing dim hallways and a confusing layout. She said the updated cafe and atrium in the center of the building serve as a gathering place for students and staff, and the link between the main and Industrial Technologies building has helped create a more unified campus. Classrooms also were right-sized after officials completed a capacity study and found that NICC's average class size was 24 students or less, so space has been more effectively used by restructuring large halls that held 40 or more. NICC President Herbert Riedel, who joined the college this summer, said the renovation campus is a valuable resource for students. "I'm a very firm believer that the environment is really a big part of the educational experience," he said. Riedel's predecessor, Liang Chi-Wei, thanked taxpayers who approved a $39 million bond levy in 2018 to fund the project. He said he is confident the college will use the completed facilities to continue lifting lives. "It's good to celebrate this building, but it's more than the building. It's about the people we impact," he said. Jim McCann of Dubuque attended the event with his wife, Donna. He described the renovated campus as gorgeous. It seems so much larger than it was when we both went to school here a long time ago, he said. Donna said the couple had earned associate degrees in accounting at NICC. She praised the new facility's bright, open design and the small work areas for students to study and collaborate. It's very inviting, she said. And a second piece from the Tri-State Dubuque page. At Loras, former Pentagon official discusses political corruption. Author and former Pentagon official Sarah Chase told a Loras College crowd this week that the U.S. shows parallels with Afghanistan and other nations she has watched crumble due to political corruption. The presentation was Loras's annual Algren International Affairs Lecture. Chase covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan for National Public Radio, but then stayed behind, founding a local agricultural nonprofit. There, she watched as government officials took power, then formed corruption networks within the region's private, criminal, and terrorist sectors. She said it was that corruption that truly led to the Taliban's eventual recapture of Afghanistan in 2021. Joining the Taliban didn't have to do with opposing Western culture or religious extremism, she said. The U.S. was seen as reinforcing and enabling a government that was so corrupt you couldn't drive 3 miles without coughing up a bribe to the police. Chase then was hired by Navy Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President George W. Bush and Barack Obama, for her insight into Afghanistan and corruption abroad. In that post, Chase said she watched political corruption spark the continuing waves of migrants out of Central America as well. You hear about economic opportunity, but not this locking up of the political economy in these sender countries that really puts people in motion, sending caravans on their way north, Chase said. You hear a lot about people fleeing north from gang violence, not the police outsourcing their extortion to the gangs. Chase called her time in Afghanistan a mirror, and said the U.S. is near the end of a cycle of increasing corruption in politics, followed by crisis. The late 19th and early 20th century was the last time the world was as in the grip of systemic corruption that we are today, she said. There was a stock market crash and a depression about once every 10 years between 1870 and the Great Depression. There were crashes in 1980 with savings and loan, the global currency crisis in 1997, then dot-coms, and then the Great Recession in 2008. Their trajectory is exactly the same. Chase said these cycles tend to end with global conflict, widespread health emergencies, like in recent years, and a financial depression. Loras student Joan Bromberbeck said Chase's report of parallel corruption at home had shocked her. Watching the news, I think a lot of sources show just the problems over there, she said, when she brought up the parallels between the corruption in their governments and ours. I was surprised. Chase said members of both U.S. major political parties have been culprits. But she said in every country she has watched crumble, deregulation, privatization of services, and more monopolies have signaled crisis. She also said a few industries play large roles. Three I see in every single country, banking, energy, and high-end real estate, she said. There are some you can add. Pharmaceuticals is a big one. But we're in Iowa, right? Industrial agriculture is a big one. Chase said avoiding polarization was key in fighting corruption's influence, nodding to Loras' Catholic roots. Love thy neighbor across the identity divide, she said. The most effective move corrupt networks deploy when under attack is playing off the population along identity lines. Shea's speech also was sponsored by Iowa Representative Chuck Eisenhardt, Dubuque Democrat, Alorus alum. We now turn to our opinion page and our view, the opinion of the editorial board of the Telegraph Herald. And today their view is on the subject of Dubuque County city officials should support airline pitch. Fingers crossed. That's the position that Dubuque area residents should be holding as officials from Dubuque Regional Airport and Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce try to broker a deal with an ultra-low-cost airline to provide 4 weekly flights to Florida from the airport. While the proposal comes on the heels of American Airlines discontinuing flights into and out of Dubuque, attracting a low-cost airline to the community was on the airport's wish list even before American's departure. Adding flight options out of Dubuque on any airline would help bolster the city's appeal as a designation to be weighed when travelers in the region are comparison shopping for airline tickets. Airport Executive Director Todd Dalsing and Chamber President and CEO Molly Grover explained their $1 million maximum 2-year agreement to Dubuque County supervisors this week as part of ongoing negotiations with an interested bargain airline to provide the flights. The proposal would use up to $250,000 per year of Dubuque County's remaining funds from the American Rescue Plan Act for 2 years, plus an equal match from the City of Dubuque. The City Council will hear the same pitch on Monday, October 3rd. The proposed deal would get 4 flights per week, 2 to Orlando, Florida, and 2 to Fort Myers, Florida, on a 737 aircraft with a maximum seating capacity of 189 passengers. The Florida spots are 2 of the most popular destinations for area travelers. While such a deal would keep Dubuque in the mix in future discussions with other airlines, it also would keep Dubuque Regional Airport eligible for the Federal Aviation Administration's Airport Improvement Plan program, which provides $1 million annually for airport infrastructure upkeep and improvements. County supervisors and city council members should get on board and support this idea. Air service is critical to this community. It's daunting for Dubuque to face a future without commercial air service. Take away that strata of transportation, and the impact to local business and commerce is significant. While flights to Florida won't fill the business traveler void, it's a move in the right direction. To strengthen Dubuque Regional Airport's position and provide options to fly Dubuque for local consumers, city and county elected officials should back the plan to lure a bargain flight airline. And we also have one letter to the editor. Voters shouldn't doubt election integrity. Susan Keyes, Kamla Court, Platteville. Election deniers wrap themselves in our flag, yet don't support our Constitution, which calls for the peaceful transfer of power. An election is free and fair only when their candidate wins. Before voting occurs, many deniers say that if their candidate loses, the election had to have been rigged. In 2020, many deniers violently stormed our Capitol, harmed police officers, and threatened Vice President Pence and legislators to try to reverse the legitimate results. Numerous investigations by both political parties and the Associated Press detected no substantial fraud in the 2020 election. In several battleground states, fraud cases totaled in the hundreds out of millions and represented votes for each presidential candidate, Reuters Fact Sheet 2022. People guilty of voter fraud should be prosecuted, as should those guilty of denying legitimate election results. Deniers use the words stolen election, so we will not trust the election process. This tactic is called gaslighting. Don't fall for it. Elections are our voice, the basis of our democracy. Deniers should put their effort into winning the next election based on policies instead of promoting unsubstantiated claims. Beware of those who peddle baseless information using a condescending tone and name-calling instead of using solid facts, evidence, and a respectful discourse. Democracy is wonderful but messy because it allows all opinions to be heard. It is our duty as citizens to weed out lies and bogus theories to keep our democracy and democratic process as upright and fair as possible. Do the work and then go vote. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken, and I am reading from the Friday, September 30th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to today's obituaries. Grace E. Wente McBride, Farley. Grace Elizabeth Wente McBride, 96, of Farley, passed away Monday, September 26th. Private graveside services will be held for Grace in St. Joseph's Cemetery in Farley. Anyone wanting to send memorials may send them to the Rife Funeral Home, attention Grace McBride Family, P.O. Box 99, Farley, Iowa, 52046. She was born on June 18, 1926, at her family home in Hickory Valley, Farley, daughter of William and Catherine Klosterman Wente. She married Leo McBride on October 20, 1956, in St. Boniface Catholic Church, New Vienna. He preceded her in death on August 15, 1992. Grace lived and farmed all her life in Johns Creek, Farley, Iowa. She was a member of St. Joseph's Parish in Farley. Matthew H. Gerard, Epworth. Matthew H. Gerard, 38, of Epworth, passed away Tuesday, September 27th at Mercy One Medical Center in Dubuque. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, October 1st at the Rife Funeral Home in Epworth, where services will be held at 2 p.m. Services for Matt will be held at 2 p.m. at the funeral home with Deacon Nick Elliott presiding. Burial will follow in Highview Cemetery in Epworth. He was born March 22, 1984, in Marengo, Iowa, son of Henry and Patricia Noel Gerard. He is a 2002 graduate of the Iowa Valley High School in Marengo. On August 26, 2006, he was united in marriage to Ann Wilgenbush at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth. Matt was employed at the Anderson Window and Door Company in Dubuque. He is a very fun-loving and husband, father, grandfather, and brother. He enjoyed the outdoors, he loved camping and fishing, and loved to tease and agitate his siblings and in-laws. He was known to all as a very hard worker. Lois A. Gudenkoff. Lois A. Gudenkoff, 86, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, September 28th. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, October 6th, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. A massive Christian burial will take place at 10 a.m. Friday, October 7th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Key West, Iowa. Pamela J. Webb. Pamela J. Webb, 67, of Dubuque, passed away September 27th at Hawkeye Care Center in Asbury. Friends and family may visit from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Sunday, October 2nd at the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, with a funeral service to start at 12, with Reverend Diane Grace officiating. Entombment will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque at a later date. Pam was born March 20th, 1955, in Omak, Washington, daughter of Eugene W. and Lorraine M. Margan Webb. She attended Stephen Hempstead High School in Dubuque, University of Iowa, Kirkwood Community College, and University of Dubuque. She worked at the University of Iowa as an RN.
She loved helping people and caring for her patients and family. Her nieces and nephews were her world, and she loved spending time with them. Earlier in her life, she loved to travel around the country with her mom and dad. A Pamela J. Webb Memorial Fund has been established. Janet L. Checker, Galena. Janet L. Checker, 80, of Galena, died Wednesday, September 28th. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Bob Roddenberg, Garnavillo. Bob Roddenberg, 66, of Garnavillo, died Thursday, September 22nd. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, October 3rd at Tucky Allen Funeral Home in Garnavillo, and from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, October 4th at St. Peter Lutheran Church in Garnavillo, where services will follow. Interment will take place in Clayton Cemetery. Now, with our passings, we have quite a few new arrivals to share with you all. First, on Monday, September 26th, Lang, Tyler and Jill Lang of Dickeyville, a girl at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital, Dubuque. Tuesday, September 27th, Lilyfeld Tuthill, Andrew Lilyfeld and Courtney Tuthill of Dubuque, a girl at Finley. St. Clair Neighbor, Zach St. Clair and Georgia Neighbor of Dyersville, a boy at Finley. Yeager, Craig and Shannon Yeager of Cheryl, a girl at Finley. And on Thursday, September 29th, Mendez Hernandez, Janeth Mendez Hernandez of Dubuque, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. Welcome aboard, all of you little ones. And we have just a couple of little bits of Iowa news on this page. The first one, first transgender NCAA athlete to speak at Clark. A former collegiate athlete who was the first transgender individual to compete on an NCAA Division I men's team will speak in Dubuque next month. Skylar Baylor will speak at Clark University at 7 p.m. October 19th as part of the university's Macon-Mailander Lecture Series, according to a press release. The event, Breaking Waves, a conversation with Skylar Baylor, will be held in Jansen Music Hall and is open to the public. The release states that Baylor was a nationally ranked swimmer in high school, setting a national age group record at age 16, and swam for Harvard University. He chose to transition while potentially giving up the prospect of being an NCAA champion and has advocated for LGBTQ+ rights and inclusion. During his talk, Skylar explores the universal challenges of trying to fit in as part of our media-rich world with integrity and authenticity, the release states. He explains his struggles and why he ultimately chose to put many potential accolades at risk to be true to himself. The event is free to attend for Clark students and employees, with a $10 general admission charge for community members. More information can be found at clark.edu. Arts at Clark. Harvest Festival Parade set in Lancaster. Mardi Gras is making a repeat appearance in Lancaster this weekend for the annual Harvest Festival Parade. The parade will take place at 11 a.m. Saturday, October 1st in downtown Lancaster. The theme this year is Mardi Gras. The parade will start and end at Schreiner Memorial Library. The route also includes jaunts down Madison, Cherry, and Jefferson Streets. More information about the festival is available online at facebook.com/ Lancaster Area Chamber of Commerce. We now continue with some more tri-state news. And we have Lancaster Theater reopens after mold cleanup from Lancaster. A historic Lancaster movie theater reopened this week after closing for mold removal and cleanup. The Grantland Theater, 218 South Madison Street, reopened Tuesday after being closed for 2 weeks. The one-screen theater returned with a 7 p.m. showing of Where the Crawdads Sing. Lancaster City Administrator David Carlson said the theater temporarily was closed after mold was found in the city-owned building. The repairs and cleaning cost the city around $23,000. Carlson said a malfunction with one of the building's recirculation fans led to a buildup of high humidity and low circulation, which encouraged the growth of mold and mildew. From detected to repaired, it took about 2 weeks, he said. We got the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system fixed, and then we hired Service Master to clean it up. They did the seats, the walls, curtains, floors. It was the whole nine yards, Carlson said. The theater is now clean and safe for use. No negative health effects were reported by staff or visitors due to the mold ahead of the cleaning. The city leases the building to State Theaters, a company which also owns and operates theaters in Platteville, Boscobel, and Dodgeville. Repeated attempts to contact State Theaters for this story were unsuccessful. In May, Lancaster City Council members approved a three-year contract with the company to continue to operate the Grantland Theater. Under the terms of that contract, State Theaters will pay the city $6,000 per year to use the space. The Grantland Theater is located within the City Hall building and was constructed in the early 20th century. In addition to movie screenings, it also hosts productions for the Lancaster Community Players, a local theater group. Carlson said the theater has become an integral part of the Lancaster community over the years. There are important elements in every small town that hold the community together: public schools, public libraries, the swimming pool, Carlson said. Here, we're fortunate enough to also have the Grantland Theater. The theater now will resume regular showings. Information on screenings and showtimes is available online at lancaster.statetheaters.com. Next, we have Manchester hits roadblock in airport expansion plans. The City of Manchester's intention to expand its municipal airport has hit a significant roadblock, and it now is up to the City Council to decide how aggressively it wants to pursue this objective. For the last several years, the city has been in negotiations with multiple adjacent property owners to acquire the necessary land to lengthen the runway to bring the airport up to modern safety standards. The city saw success with multiple properties, which were purchased with the assistance of Federal Aviation Administration grants. But expansion aspirations have hit an impasse as two property owners have ceased negotiations with the city. City Attorney Jim Peters now will prepare the council for a range of options regarding acquiring the land through eminent domain. Manager Tim Vick said the most crucial piece of land for runway expansion, approximately 39.41 acres located north of the current runway, is owned by Todd and Angela Summers. The Summers purchased the property about a year ago, but Vick said the city had been in negotiations with the previous owner, Bill Gerhardt, since February 2021. When farmland prices increased, Vick said, the city raised its offering price significantly, but the Summers have quit communicating with a subcontractor hired to perform these negotiations. The other property in question, owned by Beth Todd, is a 2.5-acre parcel located south of 210th Street. Todd currently uses it for hay crop, and the land is needed to accommodate the airport's glide slopes from the runway approach. Vick said the city offered Todd two prices, one for an easement and another to buy it outright. These negotiations have also stalled. If we're going to go through the eminent domain process, we're probably better off just buying it outright, Vick said. Vick said once the city owns the property, it could be leased to Todd. Manchester's runway currently is too small to add an instrument approach, which is required for most modern aircraft. And in some cases, because of its length, insurance companies won't allow aircraft to land. If the city is unable to purchase either property, Vick said, the city will lose FAA grants for airport improvements because the runway does not satisfy FAA standards. Vic said the FAA would like to see this situation resolved by April 2023. With negotiations deadlocked, Peters said it is likely the city will need to solicit outside counsel with more expertise in eminent domain. Peters stressed that just because the option was being discussed does not mean the council is committing to using eminent domain. Once he has more information, Peters said, the council will be able to enter a closed session to discuss the matter more thoroughly. The city already has sunk a considerable amount of money in its quest to improve the airport, and several council members expressed their desire to protect that investment. While the council did not take a vote, council members Bill Schreibring, Tanya Bradley, Mary Ann Poyner, and Dean Sherman all said they wanted to see the project move forward, but none specifically mentioned using eminent domain. We are not at this time taking actions to condemn anything or not. We're just looking at our choices, Peters said. Now we have bits and pieces of news in brief. Stretch of Dubuque roadway closed again for water main repairs. A stretch of a busy Dubuque roadway is closed yet again for water main repairs. Asbury Road is closed between Hillcrest and Cheney Road due to the work. The City of Dubuque estimates the closure will be in place until 5 p.m. Wednesday, October 5th. The closure comes about 1 month after Hillcrest was closed at Asbury for water main repair work. That stretch of Asbury also was closed for water main repairs in July. Paws, prayers come together at Platteville Pet Blessing. Paws, prayers, and pups will come together Saturday, October 1st for a pet blessing in Platteville. Trinity Episcopal Church will hold a blessing at 10 a.m. at Platteville Dog Park. People can bring pets of all types for the event to receive blessings. The event will be held just days before the October 4th feast day of St. Francis of Assisi, patron saint of animals and the environment. Blessings are free, but there's a recommended donation of $2 per pet. All proceeds will go toward the Platteville Dog Park. Suffrage contribution of African Americans, subject of Iowa exhibit. The contributions of African American women to the suffrage movement in Iowa is the subject of an exhibit coming to Dubuque. Toward a Universal Suffrage, African American Women in Iowa and the Vote for All will be exhibited Monday, October 3rd through Monday, October 17th at Lawrence College's Clower Commons and from October 18th to November 1st at the University of Dubuque, according to a press release. An opening reception for the exhibit will be held at 7 p.m. Monday, October 3rd at Loris. The exhibit is a collaboration among the Iowa Department of Human Rights Office on the Status of Women, Central Iowa Community Museum, and Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. It is sponsored locally by the Dubuque County Historic Preservation Commission. Visit centraliowamuseum.com/exhibitions for more information. And a bit more of our news in brief. Judge orders Jackson County teen detained following series of violent incidents from Maquoketa. A judge recently ordered that a Jackson County teen be placed in a juvenile detention facility following a series of violent and damaging incidents against people and property. Jeffrey S. Bills, 16, of Zwingle, was ordered to Central Iowa Juvenile Detention Center in Eldora by Iowa District Court Associate Judge Kimberly K. Shepherd, according to court documents. Shepherd ruled that Bills poses a serious risk that he will commit an act which would inflict serious bodily harm on the child of another person if not detained, and that there is a serious risk that the child, if released, would commit serious damage to the property of others, documents state. Bills was arrested September 18th on a charge of assault causing serious injury in an incident that required the victim receive medical care, documents state.
The assault was one of a series of numerous delinquency incidents in recent months, according to documents. Bills was charged with second-degree criminal mischief August 15th for allegedly damaging a vehicle in a store parking lot. 10 days later, Bills was charged with trespass, resulting in injury or damage greater than $300 when authorities said he sprayed pepper spray or mace on door handles at Maquoketa High School, causing an injury to a child. Bills was charged with disorderly conduct September 1st when authorities said he was in a fight in a business parking lot. On September 5th, Bills was charged with fourth-degree theft for allegedly removing a security camera from an elementary school. Archery hunting season set to start at Mines of Spain. The first of two archery deer hunting seasons is set to begin at Mines of Spain State Recreation Area in Dubuque. Bow hunting of deer will be allowed from Saturday, October 1st to December 1st, as well as from December 19th to January 10th at Mines of Spain, according to Recreation Area's website. Non-hunting visitors are encouraged to stay on trails to avoid hunters. Two shotgun hunting seasons also will be held in December at Mines of Spain. Visit minesofspain.org/hunting for more information. Dubuque County 4-H participating in statewide fundraising event. Dubuque County 4-H is participating in a statewide 24-hour fundraising event to support the youth organization. Iowa 4-H Giving Day will be held from noon Tuesday, October 4th to noon Wednesday, October 5th, according to a press release. It states that supporters of 4-H can visit bit.ly/3SOGYFC to make a donation. I would say visit iowa4hgivingday.org. For more information, a little bit easier to find. And now we'll wrap up with our weekend buzz. All the noteworthy things to do this weekend, and we've got lots of them. Starting with the Shellsburg Cheese Fest, Saturday, downtown Shellsburg, 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. Contests, games, live music, and vendors will be featured at the all-day cheese celebration. Food and drink available for purchase. Admission free. Galena Oktoberfest, Saturday, Depot Park, 91 Butler, Galena. Noon to 10 p.m., Galena celebrates German heritage with food, drinks, live music, and dancing, games, polka lessons, pumpkin decorating, and wiener dog races. No carry-ins permitted. Admission $10, free for 12 and under. Pet Cafe at Carnegie Stout Public Library. Saturday, Carnegie Stout Public Library, 3rd Floor Auditorium, 360 West 11th. 10 a.m. to noon. Come meet adoptable animals and bring a donation for animals in need. Refreshments are included, and a selection of pet-related books will be available to borrow. Tri-State's Largest Chili Cook-Off, Saturday, Cable Car Square, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. The 30th annual event will feature chili tasting, games and bounce houses, live music, college football game showings, and local vendors. The admission is free. Public tasting, $5 per sampling spoon. For more information, you can contact the Calico Bean Market. Dubuque Latinx Fiesta. Saturday, Smokestack, 62 East 7th. 3 to 8 p.m. Dubuque Unidos will celebrate Latinx Heritage Month with a block party featuring food, live music, dancers, and resources for the community. The first 50 people to come will get free tacos from El Paisano. Food and drink available for purchase. The admission is free. You may phone 563-582-3681 for information.
And we have the Dubuque Symphony Orchestra Classics 1, The Nightingale. Saturday, Sunday, Five Flags Theater, 405 Main. 7:30 p.m. Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday. A new work by violinist Laura Schwendinger will have its world premiere at the DSO's season opening show. A free lecture featuring the composer and William Intrilligator will be given at 1 p.m. Sunday before the performance. Admission $20 to $89. Tickets are available at Five Flags Box Office or more information at DubukeSymphony.org, or you can also get the tickets at Ticketmaster.com. Well, you have been listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. This is Ken in my regular Friday reader seat. I've been reading to you from the September 30th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. We wish you the best of weekends ahead as we move our way into fall and into October. And listen in for other wonderful IRIS programs all over the network. You can hear more than just my wonderful voice, well, at least my voice. On Fridays, we have readers Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And there are all kinds of other things you can pick up on. So enjoy the weekend and enjoy IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Network for the Dubuque area. Thank you.